May it please the court, and good morning. Approximately 15 months ago, the Missouri Public Defender Commission, in July of 2008, amended the Code of State Regulations and its rule defining the term eligible case for purposes of public defender representation. That amendment removed from that definition cases where indigent defendants had retained private counsel at any time during the pendency of the case. The issue before the court today is whether this regulation is consistent with the public defender's statutory obligation to provide representation to eligible defendants. The answer is yes, it is consistent with Chapter 600, which is the enabling legislation creating the public defender system, and its enumerated powers and responsibilities therein mandated upon the Public Defender Commission and the director to ensure an effective administration of the system. It is important to note up front that relators do not challenge the trial court's authority to sustain or grant motions to withdraw. Although in this case, realtors believe the trial court abused its discretion in granting the motion, the principal concern and argument for the court by realtors today is, did the court have the power, the authority, to appoint the public defender after allowing this private attorney to withdraw on the eve of trial in light of the regulation promulgated by the commission? Chapter 600 vests with the commission broad rulemaking authority. It states under 600.117 and 600.42 that the commission shall have the authority to promulgate any rule necessary for the administration of the system. Of critical importance to this argument, aside from the abuse of discretion argument, which is the second half of the brief, is what is contained in 600.042.4, where it states that the public defender shall represent eligible individuals. It does not state indigent individuals, but eligible. And in trying to define or interpret the term eligible, we have to go to 600.086, which states, a person shall be considered eligible for representation when it appears from all the circumstances of the case, including his ability to make bond, his income, and the number of persons dependent upon him for support, that the person does not have the means at his disposal or available to him to obtain counsel in his behalf, and, with emphasis on and, is indigent.
Could I interrupt you for a moment?
Yes, sir.
Is it the language you just read is absolutely critical to the analysis, because that language requires consideration of all the circumstances. And doesn't the regulation only consider one circumstance and make that one circumstance decisive?
The language, under the statute, there's a two-pronged test. All the circumstances refers to the indigence issue with regard to the ability to make bond. The commission has promulgated a separate regulation in the Code of State Regulations on how to determine indigence, and it parallels the statute, and then they add some additional factors. The second half of this section that requires more than indigence is the inability to obtain or secure counsel. So to answer your question, Judge, when you're making reference to all of the circumstances, those circumstances refer to the determination of indigence.
But the regulation does not determine the ability to obtain counsel at the time the person has asked for the public defender to be appointed. It determines whether or not they were able to obtain counsel at some prior time in the proceeding. So isn't that an issue that the ability to obtain counsel, the relevant time is when they ask for the public defender to be appointed, rather than whether at any time during the proceeding they were able to obtain counsel.
Judge, I think that begs the question as to whether or not the regulation is valid. If the regulation is valid, then the court has a duty or an obligation to consider the regulation as substantive law.
Well, courts are bound by the regulation is only valid if it is not contrary, if it's not in conflict with the statute, and that's the question, isn't it?
Is to yes,
whether the fact that it requires it determines if the person was able to obtain counsel to secure counsel, then they have no ability thereafter to qualify to be represented by the public defender. And isn't it, the question is whether that's in conflict with the statute?
Yes, and realtors posit that it is not. That in determining eligibility, the statute allows for the Public Defender Commission to promulgate any necessary rule for the effective administration. That allows the commission to regulate those cases where private attorneys have entered on cases. Now, the rule allows for an exception made by the director, but once the commission promulgates such a rule, then the court should consider that in passing judgment on the motion to withdraw.
Do you agree that the defendant in this case, the person, does not have the means at his disposal or available to him to obtain counsel? Do you agree that this defendant does not?
At the time the motion was heard, I would disagree because he, in fact, had counsel. He had private counsel at the time the court sustained the motion to withdraw.
Well, but take into account, I mean, you would agree that a person may begin with means and then expend those means.
And the rule allows for those circumstances where the director can make that exception. Now, I do understand that there are certain circumstances where there may be an actual real conflict of interest.
Doesn't the statute itself assume that there'll be conflicts of interest and give the court the authority to then make the determination under 600.0863?
The court will have the opportunity to make a determination as to whether or not there's a conflict of interest. The rule as written vests that discretion, and in Bergman versus Mills, it states that the legislature can delegate its authority, even if it's to a purely discretionary act. We have vested that discretion with the director. Now, obviously, the court has control over its own docket, and the court could conclude, after making appropriate inquiry, as to whether or not an exception might be granted in the case.
Well, there's nothing here that this was a conflict of interest, was it?
This is not a conflict. There's nothing in the record that indicates a conflict of interest. Attorney Hartman indicated that after 16 months of being on the case, that the only thing he did after receiving $9,000 was file his motion to withdraw.
I don't think that's what he said. That's the only thing that you were able to glean from the record. Now, this was not a drug case, so there was probably no motion to suppress. And there was, unless there was a confession, there was no motion to suppress the confession. But I doubt that there's a private detective agency in St. Francois County or whatever. This attorney may well have done a lot of work in preparation for this case. We just don't know that at this point because the record doesn't say.
No, but the record does, and in fact, Hartman testifies on page 5 of the transcript, that the only thing he filed in the case was his motion to withdraw. That was
that's the only thing he filed. But he may have done, he probably did his own witness statements and all that kind of stuff. You would expect that. Plus, of course, he had three other cases that he was doing under the same fee arrangement. Is that not true?
That is true. And they were, I think, a juvenile matter and a misdemeanor case. And he subsequently withdrew on both of those or one of those.
The juvenile case may well have been more complicated. My point is, I think I could tell from the briefing that you were very concerned about $9,000 and then he bails out at the last minute. And that's of concern to us all, I think. But it's also very easy to conceive of a situation where somebody would take a case for far less money, do quite a bit of work, and then finally be allowed to withdraw. And then at that point, it's totally vested in Marty Robinson whether the public defender gets to represent this person, or he has to go to trial without a lawyer on a Class A felony.
Well, the court always has the power under Wolf v. Ruddy our Williamson case, to appoint a member of the private bar.
And here's the dilemma for the trial judge, and that is he just let out somebody who got a fee, and now he's got to appoint another member of the private bar to serve without a fee to continue the case.
Well, Wolf v. Ruddy's, and I think that's a factor the court should consider in passing judgment on the motion to withdraw.
That's why I think that you can't consider this particular case in isolation from the granting of the motion to withdraw.
I think your problem is more with the motion to withdraw than it is anything else. It's a difficult problem, but I'm sure you realize that the private bar takes into consideration the normal case, and I guess we'd all agree that probably fewer than 5%, maybe like 2% of cases go to jury trial. And so when the private bar sets their fees, they would generally set them based on the normal progression of a case, and you wouldn't be surprised if somebody wished to withdraw if they were faced with a jury trial. And that's what the defendant in this case was faced with. And if Marty says, and I think Marty Robinson's a fine man, I'm personally acquainted with him, and he has great judgment. Marty may get run over by a truck tomorrow, and there may be somebody else in that position, and there is no appeal beyond the director as to whether this 19-year-old has to go to trial without a lawyer on a Class A felony. And that worries me.
The threshold question is not one of equity or the amount the attorney has been paid or if the attorney has been justly compensated. The threshold question is whether the regulation is unreasonable and wholly inconsistent. And that's what the case law, the standard is, whether or not it's inconsistent with the delegation of power to the commission under Chapter 600.
And that's the question I want to ask you, though. Look at the 600.068.3, which talks about, the caption is eligibility for representation, rules to establish indicency, and so forth. And it clearly provides in subsection 3 that upon motion by either party, the court in which the case is pending shall have the authority to determine whether the services of the public defender may be utilized by the defendant. Now, that language clearly gives the court the authority to determine whether or not the defendant is entitled to a public defender. It says shall.
Right, and if you look at the construction within that section, it is making reference to the determination of indigence, that either party, and I think that refers to the client or the defendant, or the public defender, has a right to appeal. The two parties involved in the question of appeal, so that the court can reassess the public defender's determination of indigence. But eligibility is something entirely different.
Well, you use eligibility, and it's in the caption of the statute, but it specifically says, shall have authority to determine whether the services of the public defender may be utilized by the defendant.
And again, I think that is, if you read the section before that, 600.086.2, I think it's making reference there to indigence, and that the individual shall apply for public defender services, and at that point the determination is made as to whether or not he qualifies as being a poor person. And if you look at Gordon v. Copeland, the court there, that was a juvenile case where the court clearly identified that it's a two-pronged test and that indigence alone is not sufficient. You have to be without means to secure counsel. In this case, Roloff secured counsel.
Are there any further questions? Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Time's expired.
May it please the court, I want to go back for just a second to the conversation between counsel and Judge Breckenridge about this regulation. The idea is this: a regulation is invalid, should not be enforced when it's unreasonable and plainly inconsistent with a statute. It's clear that this rule is arbitrary and capricious for this reason. There are multiple reasons, which you talked about a little bit on Mr. Gralick's stand, as to why someone may no longer be representing a defendant, which this regulation does not address. For example, the death of the attorney, the disability of the attorney, the disbarment of the attorney, or a real conflict of interest. Now, it's worth noting in passing that Mr. Hartman testified at this hearing. Let's not forget that before the judge exercised his discretion in this case, he had not one but two factual determinations. The first one was the first day of court after Mr. Hartman was allowed to withdraw, and the second one was a contested evidentiary hearing at which the public defender cross-examined both Mr. Roloff and Mr. Hartman. And at that time, Mr. Hartman said that there were, in his words, a bunch of reasons, and I believe that's on page 15 of the transcript, there were a bunch of reasons, and that was under cross-examination by Ms. Blau, as to why he withdrew. Now, I would feel certain that the circuit judge in every case does not want to have a large public examination of every person who seeks to withdraw as to the depth of the conflict and the reasons for the conflict. Be that as it may, he found there was a conflict, and when he did that, then that puts this rule at odds, because there are several reasons which are outside the control of the defendant, which have nothing to do with either his resources or his family and friends' resources. It has nothing to do with the fee arrangement that is between him and the attorney, which gets back to Judge Breckenridge's other point, which is, the determination made by the court of indigency is a snapshot at the moment just after the private attorney is allowed to withdraw. Or let's use the other cases I just mentioned. Suppose the private attorney died. Suppose the private attorney became disabled and unable to continue his representation. Suppose the private attorney was disbarred, which happens. It's happened in our jurisdiction and many other jurisdictions around the state.
Can a private attorney who's to be appointed to represent this defendant say, well, Judge, I have trials set every week for the next 3 months. I am overloaded. I'm a solo practitioner. I cannot take this appointment.
I would say the court has an inherent authority to appoint persons to represent the defendant.
Anybody.
And I would say that person would be very difficult for that person to refuse to represent a defendant once they're appointed.
And so the private attorney can say to the judge, this defendant is facing a felony charge. It is one that, if convicted, quite possibly to entail a prison sentence. I've never handled a criminal case before, so I don't think I'd be qualified to do this. Can the judge nevertheless appoint him?
Again, that's going to be the judge's exercise of discretion and his inherent authority.
So the discretion is, in your view, unfettered, unlimited.
I think the judge is liable for a clear abuse of his discretion. That did not occur here. I think he has the power, the authority, to appoint someone to represent the defendant, whether it's the public defender or someone else. Let's not forget, the court can appoint the public defender now. Regardless,
it comes back to the question of whether he can bypass or overlook or ignore the regulations that were passed by the Public Defender Commission. I believe that your position would be that he could do that.
Well, my position is that the regulation that is at issue is so unreasonable and plainly inconsistent with the requirements of the public defender statute that it should not be enforced. This regulation acts to refuse representation to otherwise eligible people, to otherwise indigent persons. The court had a fact hearing after which the court found this defendant was indigent. And the regulation says that even though he's indigent, that those other factors have to take a back seat to the notion that at some point in time, through the efforts of his family and friends, he was able to cobble together the price of a private attorney.
Well, following up on Judge Wolf's questions, to a certain extent, if the public defender system doesn't have the funds, doesn't have the ability, doesn't have the wherewithal to represent the client effectively within the canons of ethics, doesn't that fall into the same kind of abuse of discretion issue?
I don't
agree. We were discussing before about, let's say, you appoint a bankruptcy lawyer. If the public defender can't afford or doesn't have the funds to be able to represent someone adequately within the canons of ethics, shouldn't they be able to say we can't do that?
This court has historically held that if there is a strain, and assuming there is a strain or a crisis in the resources of the public defender system, that cannot be addressed by a regulation which limits what the legislature has said that is their duty, which is to represent indigent persons. The court said that.
But in the same token, they give regulations to the public defenders, a huge system for the director of the public defender to determine that issue, knowing their resources, to say that we don't have the assets or resources in our system to be able to represent that person within the canons of ethics, and we won't put our attorneys in jeopardy of their license.
Well, again, we're at odds, because my position is that, and this court has held in more than one case involving, including Boniker case and the Sullivan versus Dalton case, that the public defender system cannot by regulation do what they may seek to do in the legislative process or in the political process, which is seek the appropriate resources to carry out their mission.
Let me ask you this, from your point of view, in a situation where they've attempted to obtain the resources, have not been able to do so, yet have more people to represent than they can represent, what is the legal authority that you believe they have to address that concern? How do they address it if they don't have the resources and have too many people to represent?
That's a good question, and I don't have...
You don't have a position?
Don't have a position on that. What I can
Do you have a position on what the courts do with that? But, I mean, there are two sides to this problem. I mean, one side is this a valid regulation. Another is, what do we do with the problem of people who cannot obtain representation because they are indigent, yet the public defender does not have enough resources to defend all of those people?
May I say that you all sit here, and every time you have court, you evaluate the quality of the representation of every person who's represented a criminal defendant whose case comes before you. You decide, not based on the overall picture of the health of the public defender system, but whether this particular attorney in this particular case rendered effective assistance. And you find they did or you find they didn't.
But they have 40,000 cases a year. We can't hear 40,000 cases on each case to say whether or not they have sufficient resources. In essence, the legislature set up a system where they wrested control in the public defender through its board and through its director to make those assessments, being closer to the issue than we would be case by case. I mean, we can't hear 40,000 cases on this.
I was trying to respond to the concern that in a particular case, because of the strain on the system, there wasn't effective representation of this individual.
Let me ask this then. How does the trial judge determine whether or not to excuse a public defender and to appoint a member of the private bar in any particular case?
I would say that I can only speak to the circuit in which I practice, that it would be a rare instance in which that would happen, that the trial judge would look first to the public defender's office, as they did in this case. And I have not seen a situation in which they reach past the public defender system and ask a member of the private bar to do that. It was my feeling in reading, including your jurisprudence, that the public defender system was created for this very purpose.
But if the public defender system comes down to a situation where they have, say, for your circuit, which is how many counties?
Four counties,
that they have one half-time attorney to cover your circuit and the circuit immediately to the south. So all the criminal cases in that two-circuit area of several counties would be in the charge of a half-time public defender. That's the amount of resources allocated system-wide to them. Do you think in that circumstance that the judge has unfettered or broad discretion to appoint a public defender in every instance of an indigent, otherwise statutorily eligible person?
I think he does have that discretion and he does have that authority. So this gets into the conversation about where does prohibition lie, which you all are, in fact, you've had that discussion amongst yourselves.
But then the question you really have to address then is, does the commission, which is charged by statute with operating this system, have the authority to draw some lines and make some allocations dependent upon the resources available to the commission?
Yes, but I don't believe they have the authority to draw arbitrary and capricious lines like they have here. To draw an arbitrary line which says...
You're okay with the idea that they have the right to make regulations that would, in effect, confine the number of cases they have. It's just that in this particular case, you think the regulation is defective.
I think they have to make regulations which are compatible with their statutory responsibility, which is to represent indigent persons in certain situations, including this one, where they're charged with a felony.
Well, and don't the statutes specifically say that the trial court makes that decision of indigency at any stage of the proceedings?
I believe that's correct.
That's what it said.
And that's the way it is in practice, that indigency, as a matter of fact, there are several instances in everyday court life where the defendant stands in front of the judge having made a substantial bond and says, well, my family and friends made that bond. Now, that the amount of their bond and their resources, those are all things that are listed in the statute. And the judge says, okay, we've had this conversation, I've heard your side of it, and I decide to appoint the public defender. So that is an exercise of the court's discretion, the court's authority. But I want to also emphasize it's informed discretion.
The problem with it being informed discretion is the attorney who seeks to withdraw does so at a time that the public defender isn't involved in the process. And so often the withdrawal, the motion to withdraw, is the judge doesn't have anyone advocating on the other side because often the defendant is ineffective at representing his interests. The transcript in this case indicates that the defendant and his family may not have known that they were paying $9,000 only to see whether a plea bargain could be negotiated, as opposed to thinking that $9,000 would pay for representation through trial. And yet there's no one effectively to bring the facts to the trial court on those issues. And once the decision's made to allow an attorney to withdraw, then the court is left with the public defender, aren't they?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. Often people are allowed to withdraw, attorneys allowed to withdraw, and then the court asks the defendant, what is your plan? And they say, my family and I are going to go talk to another private attorney. In this particular instance, the individual said, I'd like to apply for the public defender.
Well, but one of the bases for withdrawal was that he couldn't pay the additional $25,000 that the attorney said it would take to go through a jury trial. And so isn't that the more common circumstance where the attorney is allowed to withdraw and there aren't any resources? There is no one but the public defender to represent the defendant from that point forward?
I think there are as many different scenarios as there are individuals involved, first of all. I think also that it would be very difficult for any attorney, no matter whether they come from the public defender's office or whether they come off the street as a private attorney, to delve into the relationship between Mr. Hartman and Mr. Roloff. I also want to point out, if I may, my time's up, if I may just finish with this point. If you allow the notion that the regulation is a valid exercise of the Defender Commission's authority, it has to be laid against instances, for example, where the private attorney is in one case and the public defender is in another case going on at the same time, where the defendant is placed on probation and shortly thereafter is thrown back into the public defender system with a violation of that probation, or they may have private counsel in a civil case and a public defender in a criminal case at the same time. See, there's a myriad of situations which this regulation simply does not address.
One other more question, one last question. the statute does say the public defender shall represent people that are indigent. However, if the legislature only funds $1 million to represent 90,000 people, then with the maybe the concept of impossibility comes up, and maybe this regulation is a way of dealing with that situation. The legislature can order you to do whatever you want, but if they don't fund it, then the concept of impossibility comes into play, and the public defender's got to do what they need to do. Of course, we've seen no findings on the. We have no judicial record at all on the inaccuracy of the. We have newspaper articles, we have this and that, but there's no judicial finding whatsoever in any record that the public defender is. No judicial finding at all that they are not able to handle the cases. However, if we take all these things into consideration, there would be a situation they made that finding that the legislature can't force them to take cases if they can't don't fund them to do it.
I can't disagree with what you said. I would just point out again that you have historically said on repeated occasions that it is not the role of the trial court or this court to enforce a public defender regulation where they're trying to do by regulation what they cannot achieve through the legislative
process. But the trial court
process.
Has more of an understanding what's going on in their court than we do.
And you're out of time. So.
Thank you.
How does the rule take into account when the attorney-client relationship ended in the attorney dying or becoming disabled or retiring from the practice of law?
The rule allows for the director to make an exception, and the rule is narrowed by that exception. The director will have to act with reasonableness in exercising his discretion.
He's not that decision is not appealable, is it?
I think that the court has the authority, the inherent authority, to say, I'm going to appoint you because I think you've abused your discretion in not granting the exception. At that point, the public defender, if it sees fit, can file a writ challenging the ruling of the trial court and ignoring the regulation and finding the director abused.
But the decision of the Mr. Robinson is not appealable.
Not appealable to an appellate court, but I think the trial court has the authority to say, nevertheless, you're in this case.
What happened here, basically?
Yes, and this is where we think, under these circumstances, and the question Mr. King touched upon, I think, the heart of this issue, and that is the Public Defender Commission's statutory obligation in the caseload crisis that it is confronted with to ensure meaningful representation.
What is the basis for the, clarify for me, is there any statutory based grounds or authority to issue, to establish rules other than in 600.086.2? Is that the statutory authority to adopt this regulation that you're relying on?
No, Judge. 600.017.10 states that the Commission has the authority to promulgate any rule, and I stress any rule, necessary for the administration of the system. And in the crisis that the Commission finds itself, it is entirely consistent with that provision to limit those cases where eligibility is precluded if a defendant hires private counsel.
Let me ask you this. We're having a argument today where you're representing the public defender and addressing the burdens of your position. And your co-counsel is representing the judge, or your opposing counsel. Is anybody here representing Mr. Roloff?
Not that I'm aware of, Judge.
Does he have an independent interest or right in this determination?
Well, he certainly has an interest, depending on what the trial court decides to do.
As a person who claims to be indigent in Missouri, does he have a right to be defended by you by statute?
The defendant Roloff? Indigence is not the sole factor in determining eligibility.
I understand that, but you're litigating whether or not he's eligible, aren't you?
Correct.
And he's not here to represent himself, and there's nobody here doing it.
Well, I'm here representing the public defender.
Under Gideon versus Wainwright, isn't he entitled to counsel also?
I believe so at the trial
court.
Got
so much excess capacity,
you might as
well go ahead.
Well, you have a conflict system. You have a conflict system.
The public defender conflict system?
Yeah, I mean, if he's in conflict with your determination, isn't he entitled to counsel also?
Well, that's a matter for the trial court to address.
Well, let me go back to something that you and Mr. King were both talking about.
Let me ask you that question then. Where is the lawyer that the trial court appointed to represent the defendant in this case? Is he here today?
I have not seen him, Judge. Okay. But I know that he was advised of the setting and the argument.
Thank you. My question that I wanted to ask was, under the rule, Mr. Robinson, the public defender, has the discretion to make an exception to this rule that we're here talking about. Did anybody ask him to make an exception?
Yes. In fact, since the rule was effective back in July of 2008, Mr. Robinson has made exceptions in some 18 separate cases.
No, I mean
cases.
In this case.
Yes. He reviewed all those cases where, before we filed the writ, obviously, he applied the rule and denied the exception.
Okay. When he denied the exception, did that particular action on his part, was that reviewed by Judge Pratt in this case?
No, it was not.
Do we have a
the regulation vests that discretion with the director.
What I was getting at is that the judge appointed the public defender to represent Mr. Roloff.
Correct.
And then that action was assessed by the public defender as to whether or not he should make an exception to the rule, which he has the discretion to do. And then I assume that he informed the trial judge that he was not making an exception?
By way of filing the writ.
By way of filing the writ.
Yes.
But the trial judge did not rule on the question of whether or not Mr. Robinson had abused or otherwise was within his discretionary bounds in making an exception or not making an exception.
Not on the record, but I would presume that the trial court, Judge Pratt, had the regulation in front of him and was aware of the possibility of an exception. Now, if I can just add one other thing, I know my time is out. With regard to Sullivan and Boniker, in both those cases where Mr. King says that the court held that the Public Defender Commission cannot divest the court of its statutory obligation, those cases were jurisdictional. In both those cases, the Sullivan v. Dalton case concerned municipal ordinance violations, and the Boniker case concerned PCR cases. The regulation in those cases stated, the public defender regulation, that they were not going to accept those categories of cases. So the distinction with those two cases is that at no time did any of the movements in the PCR cases or the defendants in the municipal ordinance violations ever obtain an attorney, which is the second prong of the eligibility requirement.
Are there any further questions?
Doesn't Angersanger versus Hammer still good law that if you face imprisonment, then you should be getting a lawyer?
Yes. And Chapter 600 states that if jail is a possibility.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under submission.